Hello, wake up. Greetings, Earthling.
Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to invite you to check out our new updated website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can see the show notes for each episode, get the links to all the information in the show, sign up for our newsletter, and download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am super, super excited about this interview because I've been trying to get this extraordinary guest on my show ever since I very first heard about him from Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company back last March when I very first launched the Organic Gardener Podcast. She was one of my first guests. And I immediately, as soon as we hung up the phone, I Googled him and we ordered some seeds from him and our seeds grew. We grew cantaloupe and watermelon for the first time ever up here. And we grew some corn very successfully. And so he's here to teach us about saving seeds, among other things, maybe saving our planet while we're at it. So welcome to the show, Bill McDorman.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Okay. So, and listeners, I did kind of talk about Bill because I went and actually met him in person, although I don't know if we even talked at that conference, but there was a thing at the Pennyroyal Collective down in Kalispell. So somewhere there's an episode about when I went to my seed saving conference workshop thing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself first?
Sure.
Before we get into the seed saving part?
Okay. Sure. I was a student at the University of Montana. I had gone back to school. And when I did that, I bought a little house on the old north side of Missoula. And for the first time, I was going to be able to have my own garden. I had grown up gardening with my parents. And I had been in other places where I shared. But this was going to be mine. And it turns out I had one of the legendary properties in Missoula for growing tomatoes. I had Mrs. Sorge's old house, and she was famous for her tomatoes. She was one of the original railroad families, they called them, that staked out the best ground in Missoula to live because it was the best ground to grow tomatoes. And it turned out that was the north side. And their families were largely workers to help bring the railroad through that area way back. And so I had this reputation in the neighborhood to live up to that I didn't even know about when I first got there. But I took it, I was serious anyway. And so I started looking around for the seeds that I was going to use in my own garden. And that was a thread that led me it changed my life because I'll ask this question of everyone listening to the podcast. How do you find the best seeds for your garden? I mean, what does the best even mean? Is it more than seed porn? And by that, I mean, the beautiful color catalogs that we all sit up and look at in the wintertime at night and get our juices flowing, dreaming about, this incredible harvest that we're going to have the next summer. Is that the best seeds? Or is it because you buy them from the best people? Or many of us are learning, is it because you get them from the right place? Because then they're adapted to where you live. All those things come into play. And as I ask a lot of questions, what I realize is that almost everything that my neighbors, especially Uncle Vic, I came to call him, my next door neighbor, talked about, had disappeared. All the varieties were gone. You just couldn't find them anymore. And I started digging deeper and found out that this was a worldwide phenomenon. And this was 1976, if you think about it. And I started uncovering predictions that we were going to lose 80% of all the diversity in our agriculture in the next 20 years or so. That was the prediction at the time. And so what that meant was we were going to lose 80% of all the kinds of varieties that everybody might be looking for if they were looking for the best seeds for their garden. And I thought, my gosh, that's a huge problem. And so, as I look back now, we lost 96% if you just get down to counting, which was an article that I read in the National Geographic the graphic even a few years ago, 2011. I think it's the May 2011 issue of National Geographic counted the number of varieties of things that were available to Americans in 1903 versus what's available right now. And so 96%, that's just all the little ecological and cultural niches that it took 10,000 years for humans to develop. And especially since the start of our country, we're gone. And so that's what really motivated me then to look around and try to find everything I could that was left. It just seemed like a good idea. I was a Boy Scout and I thought, God, somebody ought to, you know, if we're really gonna lose all this stuff, let's find out what we have left and make it available again. And that germ of an idea grew into a nonprofit on the north side of Missoula. At the time, it was called the Down Home Project. It's now known as Missoula Urban Demonstration Project. It's still there.
Oh, you're kidding.
And no, and as a fund, and that was started in my bedroom, in my house, on the north side of Missoula at 629 Phillips.
Okay, I just have to tell you super quick, the episode that's released today is with Ellie Costello, who is the current director of MUD.
Great, and there's such great people that have come along and have the organizations continued to grow and address the problems that they have there. That's what all good nonprofits do. We started a seed company to make available all the varieties that we had found, and it was called Garden City Seeds. And that ran for, I don't know, 15 years in Western Montana. It was for years right there at 629 Phillips, and then John Schneeberger and his wife Karen moved it up into the Bitterroot, where it lived for a long time until the nonprofit decided it was off to other missions and sold it to an entity in Eastern Washington called Irish Eyes. And so they're still running, still have the same varieties and the same descriptions we wrote for their catalog in the Irish Eyes catalog. So there's still a history there. So long story short, that's how I got started in all of this.
Awesome. I had a friend who actually, she lived in a teepee down there and worked for Garden City Seeds when they run the Bitterroot. Interesting. Okay. So do you want to tell us? I mean, I know you said that you grew up gardening with your parents, but I do like to ask about your very first gardening experience. Like, is there, like, what are you, like, the very first time you picked a vegetable or grew something? Like, where were you? How old were you? Were probably a little kid or?
Well, yeah, I don't remember how old. I must have been younger than six because my parents moved out of the house. I remember being at when I remembered this, but I remember my father pulling a little carrot out of the ground and it being a magical experience. I just couldn't believe that something like that could come out of the ground. And it tasted so good. It was a little baby carrot. It was, you know, it was like eating candy. And so I do remember that. And, you know, years later, I met actually a gentleman who came to one of our seed schools, did that in his church garden. It was a turning point in his life. And a little boy, probably 5 or 6 years old, looked up at this Southern gentleman and said, "Gene, is that where all carrots come from?"
Oh, my goodness.
And he said that's what changed Gene's life and made him lifelong dedicated to garden education. And he ended up against all other odds at one of our seed schools learning how to teach people about seeds. So I shared that experience with him. So that was my experience also.
Excellent. All right. Do you want to start there and tell us about your seed school? Or where do you want to start? Do you want to tell us about?
Well, I can let me just continue the story with Garden City Seeds.
Okay, cool.
That's
perfect.
That's my story. So I ended up graduating from the University of Montana. I was there to go to law school.
Really?
And so when it came time to sign up for law school, and when I graduated in 79, I decided that instead I would run the nonprofit that we had just started, that it really needed to get off the ground, that the seed thing was really important. And so I thought, oh, next 2 or 3 years of really hard work and this will be going. And after 3 years, I left. I was burned out, you know, like all startup nonprofits, if people are really passionate, you work too much, you do too much. I wrote the original corporating papers, helped pick the board of directors, helped get the whole thing going. We ended up buying two lots next door to my house on the north side that expanded. We planted gardens. We did trials. We had an herb garden. It was just this exciting time. We had goats and chickens and we tried to really live in a self-reliant manner, you know, the way that, say, permaculture came along and I think nailed really well later. And as the Pennyroyal Collective is really trying to do now, when I was there this summer in Kalispell, it was really great because I walked back into my own backyard only almost 30 years later. It was really fun to feel the energy and to see what they were experiencing. And so, but after 3 years, I left and I moved back home to Ketchum, Idaho, where I'd grown up. And in Ketchum is at 6,000 feet. It's tough gardening. Somebody once asked me if I had what my growing season was. And so I kept track 1 year. And we had 9 frosts and 2 hailstorms between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
That's crazy.
And, you know, and so like, it's like, what growing season? So we were at the edge kind of people trying to grow food. And yet there were a lot of really high consciousness, high quality people there that wanted really great food, the kind you only get when you grow it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I decided the seed idea was a great idea, that, you know, the world had lost all these individually and ecologically adapted seeds, and the seed companies or co-ops that had provided them. So I started a little seed company in my hometown when I went home. It was called High Altitude Gardens. Started calling it Seeds Trust a few years later when I incorporated it, Seeds Trust High Altitude Gardens. But I basically ran that for 25 years. And so that's where I really learned a lot about individual varieties and how to help people, because I had to. People kept, you know, in the early days, we had no internet. It was a catalog and phones. So I had to answer a lot of questions over the phone. And that, at the time, I thought that was a waste of time, me sitting around, you know, talking to people every day, all day. But I realized now maybe that was the richest educational experience of my life, because I got to hear so many particular problems and successes from thousands of gardeners from all over the world. And so that experience, I guess, launched me into seed school. It's that I felt like I had something to teach after 25 years. And so that was probably the germ of the idea for seed school. And probably the highlight of being at High Altitude Gardens is that, you know, I just followed my original idea. Let's figure out all the things that will grow in our area before they disappear, and get them there and then make them available. And so, you know, I got to go to Siberia in 1989 behind the Iron Curtain looking for seeds. And I ended up bringing back some real treasures that were really good for, as you might think about Siberia, were really good for high cold places. And I'm really proud because many of those varieties are still in catalogs and being sold and produced all over the world. And so it was really a wonderful moment for me. You know, they weren't mine. They were developed through the love and hard work of Siberians over the whole period. They were locked behind the Iron Curtain. I was just the first guy in from the West that discovered this and got to walk out with them, literally hidden in my front pockets. And so that was the highlight of, you know, that's probably the highlight of that whole career.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. Walked right out with them in your front pocket. And then, didn't I read something about, like, just like while you were there, like how you went around and met the farmers and talked to them and learned about how they were collecting their seeds?
Yeah, you know, we were, since, you know, this was the era, you know, so I was there in August 1989, and the Iron Curtain came down that November. Oh. You know, that's when Neil Young was over there rocking in the USA, and they actually took the Berlin Wall down. So the consciousness that led up to the end of the Soviet Union was already around, and the glasnost and perestroika. And so they were loosening up. And so we were actually the first Western group. It was a group of gardeners allowed to go to Siberia without the KGB, without interest. And so we got to stay with people. First time that they were able to open up their homes and have people from the outside stay there. And we were all gardeners. And so it was really, really great. It was a beautiful, wonderful time. Lots of tears and hugs every day. And of course, sharing seeds. I took a bunch of stuff over there to share.
Oh, you did?
And they shared. They were so open-hearted in sharing everything that was best that they had found. And so that was, you know, the background to the whole experience.
Just amazing. Totally amazing. So, okay. So then what happened next? You came back with the seeds and did the seeds trust thing, which was your
right.
business out of Idaho, selling these Rocky Mountain seeds that you must have grown them and adapted them there, or how did, is that?
Well, I grew them out and tried them. And if they worked, then we would put them in the catalog. And after 10 years or so doing this, people started sending me things from all over the world that were cold. You know, gardeners are vain. They would, you know, they'd write to me and say, or call me and say, look, you know, I know you're really proud of your winter squash and it's only like, you know, 90 days, but mine's better. Do you want some seeds? And I'd always say, of course. And so we ended up just getting, it was just hard to keep up with all the stuff that was sent to us from Mongolia, from, you know, mountains of Guatemala, from, you know, maybe some of the proudest things that I was able to grow and reproduce and share were given to me by Ken Fisher from Belgrade, Montana, who had Fisher's Garden Seeds, his original Mountaineer squash and Candy Mountain super sweet corn and Fisher's earliest corn. Those are all incredible varieties that he had hand selected for Belgrade, Montana to adapt to that climate for 50 years or more by the time I'd gotten there. And he openly shared everything with me, and he was a mentor to me. And so, you know, it was that there were all sorts of experiences like that down the road that really paid me in a way. As you can imagine, trying to run your own small business out of your own home is really hard. And
yeah, and back it didn't then, it was even harder.
Well, there was no internet, yeah. You know, I had to borrow money every year and print catalogs and hope I would sell enough to get it back. And, you know, it was just really an interesting time. Now, once the internet came, it got a lot easier because, you know, I didn't have to deposit checks in the bank. I didn't have to, you know, open up letters and look at orders and type them in. And, you know, it all got way, way easier and actually was easier to make a living. But boy, that first 15 years was pretty tough. But I got paid every day, you know, knowing that I was doing something really important, mm-hmm. something really authentic, some people that really appreciate it, you know, that I was doing. And I really believe people in 1,000 years will look back and appreciate that, you know, in two generations, we lost 96% or whatever, 93% of all the varieties. I mean, that's an incredible statistic. We need that diversity. We need all that adaptation to face the storms, I think, that are coming. And I think in 1,000 years, when people look back at us and they've grown back all these varieties, they'll look back at us in the early 21st century and go, whoa, what happened, people? How did you lose all that stuff? But look, a few people woke up and they got together and they started over and they started growing and saving their own seeds in their own homes and their own regions and readapting things and creating new diversity. You know what, folks? Those were the most important people of the earliest 20th century. We are doing, you know, anybody who gets involved in growing and saving their own seeds, I believe, is doing the best and most important work humans could be doing right now. And just to get back to what you said at the beginning of the show, this is how we save the planet. It calms people down. It gets them to think long term. It starts to feed them where they are. It lowers their carbon footprint. Almost everything we're trying to accomplish now as modern, progressive, and enlightened and traveled humans to try to save what's left of the diversity and the beauty and the nature on this planet is enhanced when you come home, grow your own food, and save your own seeds. And seed saving is the most powerful and inspirational part of that. And we'll have the most lasting impact. You can take what you grow in your garden, the best of it, and instead of starting over every year and trying to do that again and again and again, when you save your own seeds, you get to take the best out of that garden into the next year and the next and the next. And those of us that have done that have learned that after only 2 or 3 or 4 years, we start to see significant changes in how good the things are that we're growing and saving. That this system is so incredibly beautiful and adaptable and powerful that it just takes your breath away. And that makes you want to save everything. And if I'm on this mission, if we could get millions of Americans the way it used to be only 2 generations ago to grow a little bit of their own food and save a few of their own seeds, I believe everything will change economically, politically, and of course, nutritionally. And so that's why I think this is what we ought to be talking about.
Cool. Are you going to the UN thing, climate talks in Paris in 2 weeks? You should be their key speaker.
They're not ready for it yet. You know, we've got this beautiful local food movement that's starting to happen all over. When I got started 30 years ago, saving seeds, you know, because we were going to lose most of them, you know, nobody had any idea what we were talking about. You know, we were just like out there. And slowly but surely, more people are waking up. And a huge reflection of the change in consciousness for me is this local food movement. Eat local, self-reliant, be resilient in your food supply. You know, it means so much economically to your local economy. You know, I was there at the very first Missoula Farmers Market.
Really?
When there were only about, you know, 6 or 8 booths and probably 30 or 40 people showed up. And I was just in Missoula this summer. And there are, 3 or 4 distinct farmers markets now on the same day with thousands of people showing up. I mean, that's the change that's taken place. However, if you walk through that farmers market, and I did, and I walked through farmers markets all over the Rocky Mountain West this summer because I got to travel to cities all over talking about seeds. If you walk through that market and ask every farmer who's actually growing food in there where they get their seeds, all of them have the same answer. Oh, I order them. I get them from Johnny's. I get them from Territorial. I get them from High Mowing. That's most of the good organic growers get their seeds from those three companies, but they get them from somewhere else, mostly thousands of miles away. And many of the certified organic hybrids that they're growing in our farmers markets come from Europe. There are 2 companies in Europe that are really pioneering that sort of develop. And many of those varieties are patented. So you can't save the seeds. So my question for all of us and for them is, wow, how does that help local food? And I had a farmer tell me a great story. They said, you know, I almost got wrecked this year because my seed order from back east was 2.5 weeks late. Somehow it got messed up in the mail or UPS or whatever. And then I missed my plant. You know, when you live in the Mountain West, you got a short season and you got to plant right when you need to plant. Mm-hmm. And his seeds next day didn't come. Next day, 2.5 weeks later, he finally got them in just in time. But how resilient is that for our new local food economy? The only way we're going to take care of this is to take that last step and hook local food to local seeds. And when we do that, we open up a huge new a box of opportunities for all of us. Not only do we become self-reliant, but then we get to create varieties that differentiate us in our own markets. I like to tell the story of Nash Huber in Seattle Farmers Market, who every year ordered his seeds, and 1 year his favorite carrot wasn't in there anymore. And he called him up and the seeds were gone. The big company that had sold it to the company on the East Coast no longer carried it because they'd merged with another big pharmaceutical company. It's the same story over and over again. So Nash then found some seeds he had, grew them out with the help of the Organic Seed Alliance, started saving seeds and selecting out those carrots that worked best in his field. Now, when you go to the Seattle Farmers Market, there's a big, huge, long line out in front of the market, not to buy carrots, which everybody loves to see at the market. It's to buy Nash Huber's carrots. They're his variety. He's the only one who has them. And I've been told that there's even packets now of Nash Huber's carrot seeds. This is good economics, as well as assuring that he will always have his seeds, no matter what happens. you know, to our economy. And so that's true self-reliance. That's true local food movement. So that's where all of this is going. And frankly, to get back around your question, the people at the United Nations are just now coming onto local food. They have yet to take that step to hook it back to local seeds, at least many of the people at the climate talks are. There are wings of the United Nations, especially an organization called Bioversity that's based in Rome that is up on this, and they do great education worldwide. I got a chance to go visit them a few years ago. And so there are people, there's consciousness everywhere. But you know what the most important thing is? I think it's what you're doing. Getting the word out, talking to people personally, letting them tell their stories, and for everybody to go home and do it. You know, that's what we really need is to stop creating these demigods. I call them almost, you know, we have such hero worship going on around the superstar organic gardeners or the superstar seed people, you know, that are saving seeds. And of course, we need those to help inspire us. But what we really need is for a million of us to do it. And if that's what we did, we wouldn't need to fight GMOs and initiatives and spend $50 million. We wouldn't need to do a lot of the other things we're doing. Everything would change. That the act of saving your own seeds and replanting them is a ritual that goes back to the start of agriculture. It's the reason why we have agriculture. It's the reason why we stopped and built villages and towns around that agriculture. It's the reason why we have civilization. It's primordial. And when people reconnect with that, something magical happens. They change the way they treat themselves, their families, their communities, and I think they'll treat their nation and their politics different. And so that's really all we need to do. If you want to save the planet, get some seeds, go home, plant them, and learn how to save some. And it's really easy to save some of the stuff like tomatoes. Everybody can do it. You can do it in a trailer. You can do it in a pot. You can do it in your backyard. You can do it wherever. I had a guy call me once at High Altitude Gardens that was doing it on the side of an opening window at the Transamerica building in San Francisco. He was an executive in the insurance industry. And so you can do this everywhere. And if we'll all do that, I think we'll be okay.
Let me just let my dog out. Super cool. Are going to love this episode. They're going to be sitting in their seats going, tell us how to save these seeds. But one thing I want to say really quick is just what you were just hitting on and was on the tip of my tongue is how easy it is. I brought that little seed book that you guys had home from the Pennyroyal Collective. And my husband has been saving seeds like crazy since then. He read through that book every day for like a week, just constantly was looking at it. I could see like the little thing in his head churning. And then he's just been saving seeds because I've never really done that. We haven't really done much saving our own seeds at all. So,
you know, most of us are that way. You know, it's really... That's how we lost 96% of what's going on, you know? And it happened to all of us at the same time. It's the two generations, largely since World War II. And thank you for saying that. The little book I wrote called Basic Seed Saving is still available. And people can actually download a free copy, a PDF of it, off of our website, seedsave.org, if you want to go there and get that. Also, I'm just finishing up a Kindle version of it that'll be sold on Kindle. So if you've got a Kindle and you do the Amazon thing, you'll be able to get a variety edition of it for just a few bucks. And
but wait a minute, are you going to have one of those print on demand or whatever? You should have it so people can order the printed copy, I think.
Well,
we won't waste our time during the podcast talking about that.
But right. We're coming with that. You know, I'm now the director of a new educational organization called the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. And so that's my job is to educate. And our e-commerce part of that will be up real soon and the book will be for sale there.
Okay, cool.
If you download the PDF, it's downloaded in a format for you to print out. And if you print it on two sides, it will print out and you can fold it up and staple it so you can have the But, you know, the reason I brought, I love that you brought it up is that it was designed to make it easy. It was designed to be the little breadcrumbs that you follow like Hansel and Gretel into the scary world of saving seeds. And if you just start with the easy ones that are at the front and get good at that and then work your way in it, you can become a really great seed saver, like almost all of humanity has always been, you know. So anyway, this is that my little attempt. I think I wrote the book in 1994, and it's been translated into like 14 languages. I gave it away. It's all over the world, you know, and for good reason. We all need to work on this together, or we're all gonna, you know, be suffering from it. So.
Okay. Well, I'll put the link in the show notes so listeners can grab it there too.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And I just really encourage everybody to download that and check it out and see how easy it is to save some seeds. And then grow seeds that are going to help. Because that was like one of the big lessons I learned. My project this year was I planted 350 sunflower seeds to grow sunflowers. And one of the big lessons I learned was variety counts.
Yes. So how did you learn that? What?
Well, my original plan was to grow them for cut flowers to sell to the florists. And I didn't really get very many. They didn't last in their vases very long. And then I kind of changed it and decided that that's just not going to work for me. And I'm going to shoot for growing them for bird seed. And even still, it's going to take way more than 350 sunflowers to feed the birds at my house. That still wasn't enough. Like, I need to plant like 350 once a week, or maybe 1,000 a week for many weeks. Like, I don't know that we have enough property to grow enough sunflower seeds for the birds. They ate most of them, but they were pretty, and I'll probably paint a lot of sunflowers, and we'll see where that goes down the line.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, having diversity, you know, there's a little company in Oregon called Peace Seedlings, and they sell seeds. And they have in the past they've had a sunflower mix from that was developed by Alan Capular, who's really one of the great seed saver geneticists of this modern movement. And he was the scientist on the staff at Seeds of Change when that seed company got started in Santa Fe. They're the ones, they used his original seeds from his company at the time was called Peace Seeds. And his daughter runs it now and she calls it Peace Seedlings. Anyway, he spent a huge amount of energy finding all of the diversity he could find in sunflowers. And he did what is called is a Grex. That's where you take a number of varieties and put them all together and let them cross-pollinate, see what happens. It's the opposite of modern plant breeding, where we're trying to make everything uniform, you know, and genetically the same. Alan reacted to that and said, no, we need to like mix everything back up and see what's in there. And so he's done that with sunflowers. So if anyone out there has this, wants to follow your footsteps and wants to grow sunflowers, you can get an incredible genetic start by starting with Alan Capular's mix, because then what you do is over the years save the seeds from the sunflowers, from all the diversity that you're growing, from the ones you like best and the ones that work best in your yard. And that way you'll, you know, you're starting this trials in a sense to and shortcut this journey back to where everybody was before we lost all these things.
You know what I was going to tell listeners too? Make sure you go to Bill's website, because the pictures that they have on the front page, it kind of plays in this little slideshow. It's just such a great visual of what you're talking about and the difference between what we're doing now and what we want, or where we want to go. Maybe, I guess, would be what we used to have, the diversity piece and what gardens could look like and what modern agriculture looks like. It's just a great visual, that little slideshow right on your homepage.
Well, thank you. Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to say about, if you're thinking about saving seeds, say you're a gardener, you know, gardening's the number one outdoor hobby in America, right along with feeding birds. Okay, those are the two most popular outdoor hobbies in America. We have millions of gardeners. And virtually none of them save their own seeds. You know, the statistics are still really small. So if you're one of those people that wants to start, Most of you will probably, and this is just my own experience, have not done it because of what you've been taught. And the myths, I call them. One is that, well, it's too difficult. It takes too much time and energy. It's not going to be as good anyway. You know, these companies know what they're doing, and I can buy these super new varieties, and it's best just to spend the $2 or $3. Look at the value you get out of a packet of seeds, even for $3 or $4, you know. Why would I want to do that myself? Why don't I just, you know, buy them? And so those are the myths. And what I've learned is that they are myths. And I want, I guess, just a shout out to all you gardeners that, as a friend of mine from Nicaragua once said, we've all been wash-brained. You know, he stood up in one of my classes at the University of Montana. He goes, "Oh, you Americans, you've all been wash-brained." You know? And I think we have, because it doesn't take very much. In fact, it is part and parcel of gardening. I think Carol Deppe said it best. She's a geneticist that taught at Harvard for 25 years and now is a home gardener back in Oregon. She's retired. And she said, you know, until recently, until this last two generations, all farmers and gardeners saved their own seed. And all of the seed saving that was done up to that point was done by amateur breeders. All the food that we eat as modern creatures came from wild plants. That's what 10,000 years of agriculture has done. It's improved these things so that we have all these incredible, you know, incredibly more easy and more nutritious and more energy-giving plants for us to eat. And that all took place before anybody even heard the words Mendel or genetics or uniformity or these kinds of terms that are thrown around now by modern seed companies. In a sense, we did all that. Gardeners, just like every one of you sitting out there who've never saved seeds before, that's how we got all this diversity. This process is so easy and so intuitive. We can do it. We've always done it. And if you're afraid of making a mistake, get over it. The modern agriculture is the result of mistakes. If you think about how we got all the food we do, and we've got a lot of great stories that we tell in our seed school, but I'll just tell one. The best-selling and most popular winter squash in America is, what do you think it is? I'm just going to ask you, Jackie. What do you think the most popular winter squash is?
That yellow spaghetti squash? Is that even a winter squash?
Well, that's one of the most.
The acorn squash? I don't know.
Well, it's butternut.
Oh.
Waltham butternut. Everybody, you know, you can't go anywhere without seeing it in every store, every farmer's market. Mm-hmm. Waltham butternut was not produced by a modern seed company. It's not the result of genetic work in a laboratory. It hasn't been genetically engineered. It hasn't been patented. It's an old-fashioned, open-pollinated variety that anyone can save their own seeds from that was discovered as a mistake in the backyard of an insurance salesman in Pennsylvania. If he had been a really great modern genetic seed saver, like most of us think we need to be before we get started in this, he would never have allowed the squash in his backyard to cross-pollinate accidentally with something else. But he really didn't know what he was doing. Something flew in. He still to this day doesn't know what it was. Crossed with a winter squash he was growing in his backyard. And the result was a mistake, Waltham butternut, which, as I said, is now still the largest selling winter squash on the planet. And so that's how there's stories like that for so many of our modern food crops. And so if you're a modern gardener and you want to start saving seeds and you're afraid you're going to make a mistake or that you have to study and it's got to be complicated, you have to buy a $30 seed saving book so you learn how to do it right, then you've just been misled. Because if you'll just start doing this without knowing what you're doing and you start making mistakes, but stay in the game and pay attention and move things down the road to where you want them, join the club. That's how we got modern agriculture. And that's what we need now. As I said, I think it's the most important thing we could do.
Okay, so are you going to tell us like a basic, like, what, like, you know, probably, okay. So part of the reason Mike's the actual organic gardener and I'm not really is because I don't get out there as much as he does. So I'm a little more ignorant about how things work. So like the basics, like, do you pick the fruit when it's like to save the seeds? Do you start with like, do you, you have to let the plant go to seed, right? So you don't pick that fruit off of that plant, or how does it work? Like, let's pick something and say, start from step one to step, like, what's the easiest thing to save? Spinach or tomatoes or corn, or let's pick one thing and tell people, how do you save that seed?
Let's talk a little bit about which ones we should talk about first.
Okay.
All right. So when I, in basic seed saving, I divided it up into three categories. Those things that were the easiest to save seeds from, the things that, you know, the next phase, say phase two, after you've saved from the easy ones, you learn how to do those, then you move into a little bit more complication. And then the last vegetables in the book are the expert ones, ones that take you a little bit more attention. Yeah, it usually takes more than 1 year. They're biennials lots of times, so you got to pay attention, all right? And so always start with the easiest. And so by easiest in my book, what I mean is that there are five vegetables that are really common and popular that most gardeners grow that are also have self-pollinating flowers. Okay, that's a fancy term, and you don't even really need to know, you know, all the science behind that, except that it fertilizes itself. The structure of the flower is such that fertilization takes place before the flower even opens. And so what that means is you don't have to worry, by and large, that something's going to fly in over the fence, or your neighbors are growing something, or even that if you're growing something else in your own garden, that you're not going to cross-pollinate and actually mess things up. Now, there's nothing wrong with messing things up. As I said, that's what Alan Kapular tries to do with his Grexes. But if that's not your goal, if you want to keep things the way they are, it's an heirloom treasure from your grandmother or a friend gave it to you, or you just really like it, then you don't want to mess things up. So start with the self-pollinating flowered plants first. And so the five every gardener should think about first are tomatoes, peppers, peas, beans, and lettuce. Okay?
Wait, beans like green beans or beans like pinto beans?
Both.
Okay.
All right. It's both categories. And so when people ask me, they say, so Bill, how do you save seeds? I always say, well, great question, complex answer. You know, simple question, complex answer. It's complex because almost every family, there's a lot of similarities in plant families, but even down into the genera and species, there are differences. And so that's why you got to learn your way around a little. You know that it's going to be different for different kinds of things. So let's just talk about it for the ones, the five easy ones, if you're going to do that. Peas and beans are probably the easiest, because the peas, the dried peas and dried beans that you get, if that's what you're growing, are the seeds. Okay? Oh, and so if you're growing green beans, you let them dry out until they're dry beans. And you'll get that buckskin color. It starts on the pod. And you want to pick them just before they open naturally. And that's long after you would pick them as, to eat as green beans, or you would pick, say, sugar snap or snow peas to eat. You got to leave them on there longer. And if you live in Montana or the Mountain West, your season may end before they actually dry out enough. And in that case, just pull the whole plants and bring them in out of the frost and let them finish. All that energy left in the roots and the plant will finally go into the seeds for reproduction. Let them dry out until they're brittle. I hang them in the garage and I put a sheet underneath. And after a while, the seeds just start to fall out. And if they don't, you can pick all those pods. And that's known as threshing, getting them out of the pods and away from all the chaff. And those will be your seeds. And you know, if you're a home gardener, you don't even have to clean them very much, because you're just going to put them in a little bag or a box and plant them the next spring. And so who cares, with a little compost with them. So it can all be a pretty easy system. Peppers are pretty easy in that even when they're in an edible stage, you know, I've ripped open a pepper and you see the seeds inside. Just take those seeds. Pepper seeds are better and more will germinate if you let them dry out first, complete their life cycle before you do that. So if you've got time and space in your garden to allow the peppers that you're picked to save seeds from, your best plant, say, or the ones that are the color that you want, or whatever you want. You know, I mark those, let those go, don't pick them. Let them dry out completely. And then when you open them up and get the seeds out, you get that really beautiful golden pepper seed color that good seedsmen look for. All right, so there's three of the five. Tomato or lettuce, well, let's talk about lettuce next, because that's another, what they call dry method. You're just getting the dry seeds off the plant. Lettuce, you know, if anybody's ever had that experience, and most of us have, where we walk out into our garden in July or August, and that beautiful lettuce we've been eating, you know, since we planted early in the spring, because it comes up in, even in cold soil, and it loves the cooler weather, but then it starts to get hot, and boom, it bolts, or it goes to seed. And we all know that when it does that, the leaves get bitter, and so we stop eating it. And so, you know, this symbolizes the change in consciousness that we're all going to go through now as seed savers, right? I mean, in the past, I'd run out into my backyard to get lettuce for a dinner in July, and we just had the first hot day or two in a row, and I look and I go, oh no, my lettuce bolted. You know?
Yep.
And now I went out there and I go, all right, lettuce seeds, you know? And so that's the change we have to make, is just looking forward to the next cycle. You know, these things are so magical. So as it bolts, it grows up into a plant, maybe 2, sometimes 3, 4 feet tall. It has beautiful yellow flowers. It's actually in the sunflower family. They look like little yellow sunflowers or false dandelions, kind of. And then lo and behold, it's like a dandelion, the little puffs come out. And those are the things, the little parachutes on the ends of the seeds. And so when you get about a half or two thirds of those yellow flowers turned into the dandelion looking puffs, you can take that thing and shake it into a bag and get seeds. If you don't want to do anything, let them blow all over your garden, and then you'll have, they'll self-start in your garden next year. A lot of us are seed savers and we don't even know it. We're just letting volunteers come up, which is really a great way of having the plant select those things that work best in your yard without you even knowing it. If your season's short, you can pull the whole plant up before it freezes, bring it in, hang it upside down, and let it finish. Seedsmen like Don Tipping at Siskiyou Seeds pull them all when they're about half gone to seed and lay them out on tarps, and let the full plants on those tarps finish up, and then all the seeds fall up onto the tarps, and actually none of it falls in the ground, and that way he gets more seed. It'll be a bit dirty. The seeds sometimes stick together. They actually are formed in little tent packs. But, you know, a friend of mine said, oh, I'm having a hard time getting all the chaff out and getting them broken up into individual seeds. And I said, so why is that a problem? Just plant that. You know, if you plant a 10 pack and then you get a thin when they first come up, so you get early lettuce for your salads. And again, if you have a little chaff in there, that's just compost, you know. I mean, we don't have to bring this into industrial standards. I think so much of what we do about seed saving, how we think about it, is because we think it's got to be uniform. We got to think it's got to be clean and germ tested and all these things we've been taught for industrial agriculture. And when you're doing it in your own backyard, you get to do it on your terms. And so it should be fun, should be passionate, and it should be filled with mistakes, because that's even more fun. And so that leaves tomatoes. The gateway drug to all gardening, as Michael McGrath calls it. You know, 80% of all American gardeners plant tomatoes. So with tomatoes, when you save seeds, you do the wet method. And so what that means is hold the tomato as though it were the planet Earth, you know, with the place where you picked it as the North Pole, in the little bottom, you know, where the bottom is of the South Pole, and then cut it open at the equator, slice it in half. And what that does is open up all those little cavities that are filled with seeds, and they're filled with seeds in a jelly. That little jelly is wrapped around the seeds to keep them from germinating. So what you want to do is get a jar, and I always try to, when I'm harvesting tomato seeds, I try to harvest several, because I get enough goop out of these tomatoes when I squeeze it in that I get, you know, my jar is about half full of goop. And if it's not half full, put a little bit of water in there when you're done with this. Sometimes if you're only doing one tomato, you know, you're going to have to. And I've done that. I've been at dinner in restaurants where they serve tomatoes, and I liked it so much. I saved it. I cut it in half when I got home, and I squeezed the seeds out. Now, remember, when you do that, if you do it gently, you can still eat the tomato, right? So you're not giving anything up. And maybe in one tomato, you're going to get enough seeds to last for a home gardener for the rest of your life. Talk about value. This is an incredible process. If you'll just set that little jar with your goop, your tomato goop, I call it, near your sink, somewhere at 72 degrees, out of the sun, just let it set in a warm place for 3 days. A white fungus will form on the top. That's bread mold. It always happens at cold walls with this process. Stir it up a bit after 3 days when that happens. And what'll happen is all the good seeds will be loosened up and they'll fall to the bottom of the jar. And what's happened is a yeast in there has eaten that jelly away. And all the light seeds and all the phlegm and all the other stuff that came out of that goop will float to the top. In order to separate those two layers more, just fill the jar up with water. And so, and let the good seeds settle to the bottom. When they're settled there, pour all the bad stuff out. Be sure you don't pour so far that your seeds start to run out. But so I always stop short, and then I just fill the jar up with water again. And that way there's hardly any.
Put it in a strainer?
Well, no, you just, all I'm doing is water winnowing, okay? I got a jar, I got good seeds that'll float to the bottom, and there's all sorts of other stuff floating around in the water. And as soon as those seeds are settled to the bottom, it takes a minute or two, I pour out the water. And by pouring out the water, I pour out all the other lighter stuff. And I pour it down to where the seeds start to pour out, so I don't pour out seeds. That's when I stop. Then I fill the jar back up with water, and I repeat the process. And once I've done that several times, then the last time I pour it through a strainer.
Oh, okay.
Right? That way all the rest of the water's gone and I'm left with clean seeds in my strainer. And then I'll take that strainer and then I'll flip it over onto a paper towel, newspaper, paper plate or something. And I'll have a little tomato cookie of tomato seeds. And they'll all be wet and those will dry out in a day or two. And then you can use your hand to free them up from each other. And you'll have your tomato seeds. And so, you know, always label your paper towel or your paper plate when you do it so you remember which ones. You know, always put the year on them so I know what year, because I've got some of these things laying around now from years ago. And they'll keep for years, you know. We routinely, actually, at High Altitude Gardens, got 90% germination on tomato seeds that were 10 years old.
Wow. You know,
another place we've been wash-brained. These little living, breathing embryos are way more resilient than most people give them credit, you know. You do not have to buy your seeds anymore. And if you do, you're starting over. You're starting this whole ritual of adapting things to where you are and unleashing the best energy a seed has, which is adapting to where it is. And so just let's not do that anymore, people. Let's just get this going again in our own backyards and start with those five things. And you know what's great about it is you'll get so many seeds, even out of one tomato, that you'll have more than you need. And so then you get to share them. And that's really the problem most gardeners have that start into seed saving now is that they don't know what to do with them all. Oh my God, I have all these seeds now. So that's why seed libraries and seed exchanges that are springing up all over the world have become so important. And so I just read the other day, 500 seed libraries in the world have started in the last 3 years, 400 in the United States. You can't go to a city in Canada without going to a Seedy Saturday, which is one of their Saturday seed exchanges. It's becoming part and parcel of their culture. And so when they need new seeds, they don't start over. They don't buy their seeds from thousands of miles away. They don't, you know, try to guess where they came from. They actually go to a seed exchange and get seed from somebody else in their area who's already started saving and adapting things. And that way they get a piggyback off of their momentum. It's really a great scene.
Nice. I didn't even know what a seed library was till Robin came on last March, and that was the first I ever heard about it. So I'm sure listeners are still kind of new to that whole idea. All right, so I just have to say, so as the inexperienced gardener, I can't help but think other people are probably thinking the same things. Now, my husband can grow a tomato plant and a pepper plant from seed, but if it was me, I would go to the store and buy starch. So for people that are apprehensive about growing some of those, what I would term harder vegetables that maybe they've never grown from seed before. Because to me, that's where, like, letting something go to seed is more likely to happen to me, like, because it didn't get harvested in time. I'm not as nervous about that part, but I'm on the flip side where I'm thinking I would be afraid to put a pepper seed in the ground and get a pepper plant. I've always looked at Mike and been like, how do you do that? And I guess I haven't really tried, but I know one of his tips is he sprays things in the beginning and germinates them with a spray bottle. But like for people who like aren't normally the type of person that's going to start from seeds, that's going to start from plant starts. Got anything for us?
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's really a problem, find somebody locally who's doing seeds that are adapted to your region, local seeds. You know, and a friend of ours here in Arizona, Kim Castione, has a CSA for starts. So instead of delivering food, you know.
Oh, my gosh, that's the best idea.
Yeah, so once a month, she delivers all the starts that all her gardeners will need to grow what's in season. And she uses all local seeds that she's saved or other people, or she has gone down to her local seed library and checked out, you know. And so, you know, that's one way of getting back into it. So, you know, we all
don't have to. Do you want to tell everybody what a seed library is? Sorry, I was going to get to that question too. You know, I know Robin talked about it, but if they're new to my show, because it's very growing, like I said, it's still very new.
Seed libraries are, my explanation is that they're America's own reaction to the huge centralization of the seed industry. I think now we've got three companies that own 72% of the world's seeds. And so that's monopoly. And whenever that happens, Americans react. You know, we're trying to take this back. And so all over the world, people are doing it, actually. It's the same three companies all over the world actually doing this. And so a 1,000-year-old idea, Vandana Shiva, the Indian physicist who is emerged as one of the leaders in the heirloom seed movement, said to me, they have a 1,000-year tradition in India that if a farmer or gardener needs seeds, you give them to them.
Nice.
And if and when they can, they return twice as much. That's their tradition. And if anybody that knows that's been involved with seeds, you know, it's like from 1/40th to 1/400th of your seed crop you have to return. I mean, it's such an abundant process. So to return twice as much is nothing, really. You know, you might have to return a fourth of the seeds in one tomato, you know, if you got checked out seeds out of a library. And so that's how seed libraries work. They become our own kind of institutional way of doing this. And so a seed library is where you would go in and look in a card catalog. And for the seed libraries that I've helped start, and my wife and I, Belle, when we were directors at Native Seed Search in Tucson, Arizona, you would go in and you would see envelopes. And on that envelope would be the variety of what it is, and then also a story about where it came from, where it was named, where it was grown, what was going on. You'd find something hopefully in your neighborhood, if not, you know, your region, something that you liked or whatever, and you could check out as many seeds as you wanted. And then if and when you could, you would learn how to save some and check in twice as much. And so some of these seed libraries now have been going for 3 years, and the majority of the seeds in them have been checked back in now by people that lived around them locally. And so it's really a beautiful, beautiful American expression of how we're going to keep this momentum going locally for having our own varieties and strengthening our own, you know, local food systems in a way that's not market-based. That's just ours. It's back in the public domain in a sense. And so I like that idea.
I love that idea. You know, so I did make a little note on the bottom. Do you want to touch on legality? Some people are probably going, what is this guy talking about? You can't regrow a seed. Some people might be like, I still have a huge thing about wrapping my head about it, that somebody could own a seed and say, if you grow a plant, you can't replant those seeds. And apparently, like, in that, we watched this GMO OMG movie a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about Monsanto putting farmers out of business by suing them, or it might not have been Monsanto, I guess I shouldn't say that, but some companies like trying to say you can't grow this corn, and even corn that's like coming to their fields through cross-pollination, you know, and just different things like that. That, like, do you want to talk about the legality of it at all?
Well, you know, if you think that it's an outrageous idea that somebody could own a plant and the seeds from it, and therefore prevent you, you know, from doing what you wanted with it, then you're not alone. Almost all of humanity forever has thought that. You know, it, the first plant patenting legislation that was passed in the United States was actually in the 30s. And we teach this in our seed schools. I'll just make a little plug for that. We have a six-day program where we teach people all about seeds. And actually, we have an online version of it now that maybe you'll post a link to also. We're going to be
I will, and plug away. Tell people. I know this is what they're listening for. They want to know about it. You just
tell
them. You know, they want to know.
Well, and we go into the history and how we got here, you know, through all, and the legality of what's going on in a larger, because it's really important to know why we're all doing this as well as how. And then Seed School, you know, excels in teaching you how. We, you know, it's my 30 years experience. We've had experts. You know, we've graduated, I think, 700 students now from all over the world through our programs. And every one of them has taught us something. We've taken feedback. We boiled all that down now into an online version, a 6-7 week online version, which is a webinar once a week, you know, that people can tune into. And they're recorded, so you don't even have to be there at the time. But if you are, you can ask questions, kind of thing. And you really can learn a lot. So anyway, in the 30s, the first plant patenting legislation was passed, and it on purpose excluded seed-bearing plants. There was no way they were going to allow people to have that kind of control over seeds. I mean, it's part and parcel of farming and gardening. Everybody knew that. That's how we got the agriculture we have. Everybody could grow and save and share seeds. It's part of the public domain. It took lobbying until 1970 during the Nixon administration to pass the Plant Variety Protection Act, which for the first time allowed companies to patent plants and their seeds for the first time. But it made some incredible exclusions, like farmers could still save and use their own seeds after that, and multiply them and use them for whatever they want. They just couldn't sell them again. If they did, then they had to pay a royalty. Well, that system through our courts and through other legislations evolved now to where companies can get utility patents and have total and complete control. And that's where you hear the stories about the large companies suing farmers because they have a genetic material on their farms that they did not buy. And even though in some cases there's a lot of evidence that those farmers didn't on purpose buy those varieties or that genetic material, that it actually just blew in from drift, some courts have decided that that doesn't matter, that they're still in possession of somebody else's property. And so that's where you get all of those sorts of problems. I don't think that the legal the ending legal precedents have been set around this yet. I think that there's more to go in the courts, and that in the end, they will give farmers as much credence around a law that has just as old as contract law. And that's the laws that allow you to protect yourself and your property. So if somebody comes on your property and causes damage, then you're able to sue them, have redress. That's, you know, that goes all the way back to the Magna Carta almost. And contract law is what these large seed companies are using in court to say, hey, you know, we have a contract with these farmers that they're not going to use patented material in an improper manner, and they're suing them around their contracts. And so far, the courts have ruled around contracts, and they haven't ruled around the other, but there hasn't really been some really great clean cases yet, I don't think. And so, you know, again, you can get really caught up in this, and there are a lot of people, there's a See Justice movement right on, you know, there are people addressing policy and trying to get, you know, things changed around these sorts of issues. I personally have put all my energy into teaching everyone I can about how to save their own seats. And again, I think if everyone just takes part in this process, if we had millions of Americans doing this, then the consciousness around these laws would quickly change, you know, at other levels. And so if you really want to focus on changing things before you go off, you know, to fight the world's largest corporations, let's make sure we have our own food system first. You know, there's something
cool. I like that better.
The French anarchists about that. You know, before you go throwing rocks at the people that provide your food, maybe you should provide your own first, you know, kind of an idea. And so that's what I'm really passionate about. But again, what's really great about Seed School is that you'll be brought into this network of people that are studying these things and take it very seriously and changing their lives. We've had 14 of our students start their own seed companies, small little regional seed companies. You know, Robin actually came to Seed School twice, which is really great, you know, and she gets help all the time. You know, from either the other members of Seed School or from us or whatever. I mean, we're here to help. That's what we're here for. And when I got started, when I go way back to in college, University of Montana, 1976, and we discovered we have enough varieties to start our own little seed company. You know, we had not heard of the word seed exchange or seed library then. So maybe that's what we would have done. But we thought the only way to get those out there was to have a little company. There was nobody to teach us how to do it. There was nobody. I did 25 years of making mistakes about how to organize people around seeds and get them out there and to teach them about it. And that's what happened to me 5 years ago. I woke up and I realized that I was the guy I was looking for, you know, in 1976, that my whole life had gone by. 34 or 5 years of, you know, just making mistakes, trying to figure all this stuff out. And so I thought, well, at least I can do, you know, now I'm in my 60s, is pass on everything I've learned quickly, you know, that might be an important thing. And it was out of that idea that Seed School was born. And now, I'm proud to say we've had hundreds and hundreds of students from around the world. And they're all going off. In fact, last year, actually, this past spring, we had our first Seed School teacher training, and we trained 19 seed savers to become teachers so they could teach their own seed schools and teach for us when we have seed schools. And so it's even taken another level. And in fact, we're going to do another Seed School teacher training in Los Angeles coming up in March 14th to the 18th. So if any of your listeners are interested in that, it would be a nice combination because we use as the core of the curriculum for that what we teach in Seed School, but then we get hands-on twice a day. You'll be presenting this material to other people and perfecting your techniques and learning really how to communicate all this information in a really effective manner. And again, then you'll be part of a network of all these other seed teachers. So that's something that, you know, I'm really proud of that we're doing.
Awesome. And then did I see something else about your presenting in Oregon at a seed conference in Oregon?
Yes, the Organic Seed Growers Conference.
Yes.
is held every other year. And it's probably the largest gathering of organic seed growers. These guys aren't necessarily seed savers. A lot of them are interested in breeding their own seeds. But this has become a big business. The organic food movement now is a $35 billion industry. And so, it's put on by the Organic Seed Alliance, who have done unbelievably incredible work around education to become better seed breeders. So their conference is February 4th for the 6th. And so I'm going to be on a couple of panels there. One is about how to bring education into your seed operation as another profit center, you know, so that you can make some money teaching people as well as with the seeds. I know Robin is interested in that. It's hard to have little seed operations. And so This, you know, I'm just, we're going to teach about the experiences we've had on how to do that. And then also I'm on a panel with Talk to the Elders, people that have been around. You know, it's hard to believe, but that 35 years have gone by, and that makes you an elder. But 35 years is more than a lot of the people have been around. And there's some things I think that some of the guys that are going to be on this panel will have to say that that could save people's steps. So I'm proud to be on that also. With and I'm going to be on the seed education panel with my wife, Belle, who is actually the administrator and done the mechanics behind our seed schools. And so it's going to be a really great, you know, workshop on how to do, you know, seed education. We're really proud. We're going to share that workshop with Rowan White from Sierra Seed Co-op in California that does her own 5 and 6 day programs, and Don Tipping from Siskiyou Seeds in Williams, Oregon, who has another fantastic on-farm 5 day seed teaching program for people. And so we're all going to share experiences there. And then, you know, we're going to do one other thing. We've got a grain school coming up at the University of Colorado in January 15th through the 17th. And this is University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And it's a 3 day event where we're trying to bring people together to talk about grains, all the ancient grains and the new grains, and how you grow and save and breed, and then how you brew and grind and eat and evaluate, you know, grains to help kickstart that part of the seed movement and the local food movement. So that's going to be really exciting.
Nice. I might be able to get my husband to actually go to that. He's really interested in grains and is always asking me about getting some grain seed. And then do you know that Bob Quinn, who has that ancient grain, the Kamut?
Yes.
Organic in Big Sandy?
Yes, I do know. I met Bob years ago. And that's a great example of the how going out and finding older varieties that are adapted to our climates, that have really special properties. In this case, they were just more nutritious. My gosh, whoever bred what we call Kamut was superior. Those people paid attention for a long, long time to produce that grain. We think, again, that this has to be done in a laboratory these days, and it's just a great example of how we can take advantage of what humans have always done best, and that's find these things and bring them back into our local economy again. Bob doesn't have any competitors for that. You know, you find, instead of like trying to grow hard red winter wheat where you don't even know what the price is going to be because it's a world commodity and traded by the end of the year, you sell something that nobody else is selling that works for you in your region. And so, you know, the grain thing has huge potential for people to follow, you know, in Bob Quinn's footsteps, so to speak.
Have you read that book, Lentil Underground?
I just saw it, but I haven't read it. But that's another great, you know, all this stuff is happening so fast. It's just great.
I know. I just got it out of the library. Like, I'm only a few. It's an amazing story. She's such a great storyteller. And so I'm just learning to read that.
But yeah, me too.
And my interview with Bob Quinn was one of my favorites. He's just a total visionary.
Yes.
And selling it over in Italy, you know, with the home of pasta, you would think, you know, they would. It sounds like they're some of his biggest customers. So,
you know, the farmers in Arizona grow durum wheat that's used for pasta that's shipped to Italy. And then the pasta is shipped back here. And the farmers that grow it in Arizona are barely making it some years, depending on the cost of this commodity, you know. And it's shipped all the way to Italy to make pasta and then brought all the way back. And, you know, you go, wow, how long is that going to last? That kind of a fossil fuel based system, you know, that they'd be way better off growing, in my opinion, white Sonoran white wheat, which is a 400-year-old adapted wheat that was brought by the first missionaries to Arizona, that nobody is growing, that's adapted to the climate there, that is actually was used to create the first flour tortillas. That's where the whole idea of a flour tortilla came from. So you got a local food that was invented in the Southwest with a local wheat that invented it, and there's only one or two growers now growing it. And they, one of them came to one of our seed schools and got the idea there. And now it's growing, you know, I heard the other day, we went from a few handfuls of this lost heirloom wheat to 1,100 acres was planted last year in southern Arizona. So people are following in that sort of that Quinn model where you start with just very few. What did they do? They start with 40 kernels, 48 kernels to Kamut. And now there are literally a million acres or something being grown. It's just a phenomenal story.
Cool. Yeah, because my husband, he really wants us to be as, you know, self-sufficient as we can be. And he really wants to grow wheat. Our thing's been water. So last year was really the first year we could plant anything. And he planted a very small wheat crop. And then this year he planted a little bit more. And you know, finding wheat seed, his goal is to find his own, grind our own wheat. And he loves to make bread. So make our own bread and just, totally right along what everything you're saying.
Just before this modern period, there were 30,000, this is an estimate, varieties of wheat being grown on the planet. 30,000 different varieties. And so what I would say to your husband is go wide. And there's another really interesting one. He was a student at one of our seed schools, Jacob Calgill, who for a while worked for Bob Quinn, who has started a seed co-op in Western Montana. I think it's called Five Valleys Seeds.
Okay.
And he has started with some systematic trials on a wide number of varieties of grains for Montana. So that's what you'd want to do first, is grow as many different kinds of things as you want, as you can find, and see what works for you right where you are. And that way you can bring out some of this diversity and really, you know, hit a home run faster. If you can find something that works for you, wow. And as Jacob said to me the other day, it was a real surprise what worked for him. He would not have predicted the kinds and varieties of things that he thinks he'll go on with now and increase. So that's just such a great period to be a part of, that so many people are starting to take part in this work.
Okay, we're going to have to wind this up because we're getting past the point where I can even save it in an episode and post it. So do you have anything you want to say to kind of wrap things up?
Well, just have fun. Be passionate. Okay. Make as many mistakes as you can. We can do that as home gardeners. If you make a living off of what you grow, if you're a market gardener or a farmer, you need uniformity in your crops. You need to be able to predict them. You need seed that has been grown with more complications and more education probably behind it. And so there's always a need for us all to get better as seed savers. But don't make that mistake where you think you need to be pure and scientific to save seeds to be a home gardener, because you don't. In fact, home gardeners making their mistakes is how we got all this diversity. And that's what we've lost. And that's the most important part of this foundation. So I'm hoping that people feel empowered and that they can take part in really the most important part of this. And that's just saving seeds. And then start down that path to make yourself a better seed saver. And then once you get to the point where you really want to figure it out, you can buy those more expensive books. You can take those other courses. And if people want to get a jump start on this, our next seed school online starts February 9th. And again, at seedsave.org, you can find a link to sign up for that. And we'd love to have you. We have people, again, from all over the world signing up, and it's really a great way to use technology so you don't have to go anywhere this winter. You can hone in. So thank you. This has been great for me. It's just nice to have someone, you know, that wants to listen. So I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, there's probably quite a few of them out there. I think I'm up to about 500 listeners finally. So somewhere in the 400 to 500 range. It seems like almost every episode has been downloaded. That's like the minimum now. And then most of them are getting up in the thousands. In a thousand, getting close to 1,000, 800, 900,000 downloads per episode. So,
doing
pretty good for a new podcaster compared to, I don't know, people in my podcasting group, we kind of, every once in a while, someone will be like, here's my milestone. And I know I'm at the top end of my, you know, I'm certainly not in the people who are getting 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 downloads a month, but we're growing. So, you're speaking to a lot of people, Bill.
Good.
Thank you.
Congratulations. I really enjoy your passion. What you're doing is important, so.
Thanks. Well, what you're doing is super important, and thank you for being the massive educator. And I'm going to try to come to that thing in Oregon for sure. I don't know if I'll really get my husband to go to Colorado, but he is originally from Colorado. I just don't think there's any family down there. His grandmother lived right in Colorado Springs. We've been there. She had a cute little house, like, right outside of there in a little town. And I think listeners have learned a ton today, and they're going to go to your website and learn even more, and maybe some will go to seed school, and some of us won't be scared to try to grow a pepper plant maybe, or a tomato plant from start as much, or we'll save some seeds and give them to somebody who doesn't know how to do that.
Great. And, you know, folks can also, if you're in the Rocky Mountains, go to the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, rockymountainseeds.org, and sign up for our newsletter, and you'll stay in touch with all the stuff we're doing. So that might be, it's free. You can become a member. It's great. And so the whole idea is we're going to try to make the Rocky Mountains self-reliant in its own seed production. And so that's a big job, but if you're there, you can help us. So.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening. And remember to grow local.